Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're happy to have two Stevens in the studio today, Stephen Dubner and Steve Levitt. They're co-host of Freakonomics Radio and co-authors now of the new book, Think Like a Freak, in which they offer to retrain our brains and teach us how to think outside the box and about the box and around the box. They're with us for a three-part series this week. Today they'll tell us why thinking like a child is part of the Freakonomics mission. Stephen Dubner, hello.
Hey, Brian.
And I see you around here all the time because you do Freakonomics Radio. Stephen Levitt, also of the University of Chicago. Hello.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Good. So, Dubner, kids are like blank little slates. They come into a situation knowing nothing and thinking nothing. This is a good thing?
For the most part, it's a great thing, yeah. So it's funny. Since we wrote this chapter, Think Like a Child, as part of Think Like a Freak, I've just seen this so prominently everywhere in my life with my own kids, but just look at society in general. So we look at kids as these kind of inchoate, incomplete, lesser versions of ourselves, which is in some ways obviously true. There's some things that kids really can't do, but there are a lot of traits that they have that are great and that we should exploit and harness and steal as best as we can. There's curiosity. There's a willingness to ask questions that might not be so reverent and so on. And there's just an appreciation for possibilities that adults tend to magically evaporates from adults, it seems, at about 21. So the other thing is that kids pay attention in a different way than we do. So adults need to pay attention to one thing at a time, like driving or reading a contract. And kids have this diffuse attention. What that lets them do is actually see things that we don't. And so we think it is a great idea to harness that inner child even after you get old, like 24 or 5.
Yeah, that old. So, listeners, we've got a few minutes for some of your calls. Maybe it's like the Brian Lehrer Show edition of Kids Say the Darndest Things. So parents, teachers, babysitters, anyone who spends time with kids, what's an example of when a kid asks you a question that got you thinking differently about a problem? Because that's the point of this chapter of Think Like a Freak, is to apply this to grown-up problems, not just to love up our kids. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Can you think about a time that a kid asked you a question or said something that got you thinking differently about a problem that you were trying to grapple with in some way? 212-433-9692. And Steve Levitt, you spend a lot of time in the book on bias, and certainly in this chapter. So would you say that preconceptions are the biggest challenge or one of the biggest challenges to thinking differently and to thinking like a kid?
Yeah, I think the world's complicated. And we don't have time to try to figure out the answer to every question. So I think having a lot of preconceptions and going with the flow and the conventional wisdom is often the right thing to do, just it saves you time. But if you really care about an answer, if there's a problem that gets you excited and you want to get to the bottom of it, so often what I've seen, say, for instance, working with businesses is they immediately jump to the conclusion that they know what the right question is and they know what the right answer is, and all discussion and insight gets foreclosed. And that's one of the things about kids, is that they know so little about the world around them that they say things that are crazy and usually wrong. But the great thing, something in economics called free disposal, which is if you have an idea that's no good, you throw it in the garbage. And so that's the thing. If you can create a lot of bad ideas, sometimes you get a few good ones tossed in with that mess.
And you didn't just say, we think we know what the answers are. You said, we think we know what the questions are.
Yeah.
Which is not automatic either.
Yeah, no, I think oftentimes people don't even ask the right questions because you start. I see people who are frustrated and angry, and a lot of times if you can just slow them down enough to ask them, to get them to figure out why they're even angry about a problem, they realize it's not for the reason they thought it was in the first place. And so that's, we say, start by saying, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I don't even know what the question is. And then you get freed up.
And Stephen Dubner, thinking like a child also involves thinking small in many instances. And in the book, we notice that you write that you two have never solved a single big problem.
Not for want of, not for want of, you know, it'd be nice if people like us or even, you know, politicians, the people who we think are charged with that. You know, when you think about the big problems, poverty, famine, income inequality, health, various health stuff, and you think about those and you think about the way that we as a society try to, quote, solve those problems. And if you could turn off your blinkers and turn off what you think is kind of the right way and the wrong way and the effective way and not, you realize how absurd it is really, because these problems are big and entrenched, full of all kinds of people with different competing interests and incentives. And so big problems rarely get solved. You know, you can think of Norman Borlaug, I think, is a great example, the plant chemist who years and years ago figured out how to re-engineer rice and wheat to grow more crop per stalk and per acre. And this one guy is probably responsible for the lives of 2 or 3 billion people today. That's a big problem that one guy solved. Most of us aren't so lucky or good. And therefore, we advocate that thinking like a freak means peeling off a small piece of the problem that you can actually have a chance of doing. Most, quote, big thinkers are not interested in that, but we're not interested in being big thinkers.
Steve Levitt, good example of that?
Yeah. One of the best examples I love from our book is on the question of education. Everyone's trying to get kids to do better in school. And people approach it with the idea that, well, we need to, you know, squash the teachers' unions, or we need to, you know, revamp the curriculum. But a couple of economists, I think, really were thinking like children when they happened to be in China and noticed that none of the kids wore glasses. And they knew in their own kids' schools, kids were wearing glasses. And they figured, well, I presume kids in China can't see either. And the solution was to just to deliver really cheap glasses to kids, because you simply can't learn if you can't read. And it turned out that they had a really big effect on the kids who couldn't – when they could see, they could read. Although, interestingly, in the spirit of unintended consequences, what was surprising is that a lot of the kids in China wouldn't wear the glasses because they would be bullied and teased for wearing glasses, which is amazing how you learn about how much we're all alike in the end.
Yeah, except in this country now.
In this
country, glasses is a fashion statement.
Yeah, right?
Now, if you're a hipster and you don't need glasses, you just get blank frames.
Yeah, there's something like a million people wearing frames with non-prescription lenses a day. Yeah,
I like yours. Orly in Manhattan.
These I need, though, just so you know.
You're at WNYC. Hi, Orly.
Hi. So we were driving upstate. The car was packed with boxes and pillows and lots of stuff. We're schlepping up there every weekend and taking stuff upstate for the summer. And my four-year-old was in her car seat right in the middle, smack between all the stuff on either side. And she was pushing out her elbows and crying and whining about how she didn't have room, how she was uncomfortable, how all the stuff was in her way. And I was like, look, I can't do anything about it. You know, well, it's not really bothering you. Just look the other direction. And she was still crying. And then it was quiet for a while. And she said, I'm going to think of these boxes in a way where they can be friendly to me. And I'm going to make a long list of all the reasons why I can like these boxes and why they can be my friends. And I can think of them in a different way.
Aha. Uh-huh. So instead of moving the boxes out of her way, instead of moving the boxes out of the way, which was the problem as you defined it, she figured out a way to have a different relationship with the boxes.
Yeah, I mean, it was impossible to move them. They were piled high on one side of the car seat, and then there were pillows and clothes and stuff on the other side. And so at first she was punching it and getting angry and frustrated, and then it was just silent for a while, and she came up with an idea to think of it in a way and was trying to think of the boxes and stuff in
a
way that could be her friend.
Orly, thank you very much. I once had a therapist who said, like what you don't like as a tool. It's really hard to do that when you're a grown-up.
You know, it's funny.
Her story,
Orly's story and her kid reminds me of something we talk about in here, not thinking like a child, but we talk about how important and valuable it can be to change the frame of a relationship, and that a lot of you know, transactions in modern life are pretty – not necessarily hostile, but can be adversarial. And so whether it's with a government or between friends or in business, if you can shift a framework, if you can nudge it from kind of, you know, a financial transaction or an authority transaction into a collaborative one somehow,
is
you can
kind like,
of make everybody feel, you know, a little bit more like a stakeholder.
Is that like the story in this chapter about lotteries and personal savings? You had this like prize-linked savings account.
Yeah, that was neat. So – you know, here are a couple competing factors. Americans love to gamble, play the lottery, spend many, many billions of dollars on it. If you're doing it just for fun and you have the money, you know, it's pretty not a big deal. But if you're doing it as your savings and retirement plan, it's a big problem because it's a big money loser. So people do love to gamble. We don't love to save. So there's an idea that has been practiced in many countries and is starting to gain some foothold here, which is called a prize-linked savings plan, which is you take your money, put it in the bank, the principal stays, a small portion of the interest gets pooled with small portions of all the other depositors' interest, and then once a week or a month, whatever, there's a big random payout, a lottery payout of a 10 grand or 100 grand even, and so you get to – it's called the no-lose lottery.
Uh-huh.
Which is a nice way to trick people into doing what's good for them while also having fun, and fun being a primary component of thinking like a kid, for sure.
Let me wrap this up with your great George Bernard Shaw quote from the book, and then you'll be back tomorrow to do more Think Like a Freak on another theme. But you quote George Bernard Shaw, who reportedly said, "Few people think more than two or three times a year. I have made an international reputation for myself by thinking about once or twice a week."
Ha.
Now, surely George Bernard Shaw wasn't referring to our listeners. Our listeners are thinking it only a notch or two below Shaw levels, no doubt. But what do you mean by suggesting that people don't take the time to think or think about how they're thinking?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in a business setting, people are so busy and have so many meetings that getting them to slow down to think. I mean, the example I give is I'm an academic, and it's our higher education system is so broken that I only have to teach about, I don't know, 60 hours a year, and it gives me time to think. And so, I mean, the joke I always make, which is true, is that I spend about an hour a day thinking, trying to come up with ideas, and I have about one to two good ideas a year, which doesn't seem like a very good ratio. I mean, it's, you know.
But in academia, that's what you get by.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you cobble together 10 ideas, you turn it into a book like Freakonomics, you sell a bunch of copies. It seems like a pretty good investment after the fact. But I think, you know, the number of people in the U.S. who actually spend an hour a day thinking or a half an hour a day thinking, I bet it's close to zero, absolutely close to zero. But, you know, I think I do. I have the luxury of thinking. I mean, it's certainly a luxury to be able to do that.
At least you guys put new ideas into each chapter of each of your books. I had a professor in grad school who had basically two hypotheses, two experiments that he did, and he wrote them up in slightly different forms and, you know, 16 different journal articles and gave presentations about them, and he had a commercial book, and it was all the same, like, one piece of data. So,
well, that's why these books take 4 years, unfortunately. If we could repeat ourselves a little bit more often, we could come out with books more frequently.
And the new one is Think Like a Freak. They will be back, Stephen Dubner and Steve Levitt, tomorrow for one more Think Like a Freak tour chapter with the theme of persuading the unpersuadable. That's what you'll do tomorrow. Also, folks, if you want to see them in person tomorrow night, the Steves will be at Symphony Space to talk about the book. And you, as a WNYC listener, can get $10 off the ticket using the promo code WNYC. There's a link on our website. For more information, go to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Stephen Dubner, Stephen Levitt. See you tomorrow.
Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you.
And we'll see Michael Pollan coming up shortly. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned.